Hey folks, Micah here. We're about to get started, but before we do, I just want to remind you that you can always get show notes for this and every other episode at ChristianTransHumanistPodcast.com. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for email updates so we can let you know when new shows are released, when new things happen in the Christian transhumanist community, and most importantly, so that we can connect you with other people just like you exploring questions just like this. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy the show. All right. Well, my name is Micah Redding, and I'm here with N.T. Wright, a leading New Testament scholar, theologian, retired Anglican bishop, and the author of the new book, Paul, A Biography. Thanks so much, Dr. Wright, for joining me today.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
So I want to talk about Paul. I want to talk about your book. I want to try to frame this in the context of your larger work, though, and I think my first exposure to your work was through your dealing with the historical Jesus, the kind of history,
okay,
the questions of the kind of historical context of the New Testament. And I've gotten the feeling over the years that a lot of Christians have pushed back on that, saying something essentially along the lines of, well, we've got the Bible, why do we need to study history? So I wonder how you would address that question.
Yeah, this is a big and important question, which I have done a lot of work on over the years, and I've met precisely the kind of objection that you raised. I mean, there's a pragmatic reason, which is that for the last 200 or 300 years, ever since critical history really began properly in Europe with people like David Hume and Gibbon, people have scratched their heads and said, wait a minute, those Gospels were made up by people who were part of this church movement thing. We suspect they falsified the record here and there and added all sorts of things and invented it. So the church has, ever since then, the last 200 or 300 years, found itself slightly, to use an English metaphor, on the back foot, thinking, well, actually, we sort of believe these Gospels, so maybe we have to do a little bit more legwork to show why we should believe them and why you don't have to leave your brain behind at the church door, if you like. And I think that's a perfectly sensible and laudable pursuit, to say to people in churches, you have read in the papers and in various books that you can't believe this stuff. Well, actually, you can. This stuff does make sense in the first third of the first century in the Middle East, the area that later gets called Syro-Palestine and is variously called Judea and so on. The more we do the history, the more it does make sense. So there's that basically pragmatic thing. But the other, perhaps more important, is that throughout church history, the church has, without realizing it, regularly taken things in the Gospels and interpreted them in subtly different senses, the most obvious being the interpretation of the phrase kingdom of heaven as referring to heaven as a place where saved souls go when they die, whereas it's quite clear from a glance at first century history that Malkut HaShamayim, the Hebrew Aramaic phrase underneath kingdom of heaven, is all about God's rule on this earth, not taking people away from it. So a little bit of historical study goes a long way. And of course, underneath that as well is the fact that the New Testament is written in Greek, and if you want to understand what it means, you have to look up words in a dictionary, and the dictionary will tell you how those words were used at the time, which is, of course, a branch of history. Lexicography is itself a branch of history. So you can't escape history. The question is whether you're going to have good history or bad history.
Yeah, that's a great point. We most of us don't read the original Greek, and even when we do, we're relying on all this historical work.
Well, of course.
Yeah. So, but you kind of brought up a subject there that is another of your kind of big topics that you deal with that maybe changes how Christians think about their place in the world, and that's eschatology, the story we find ourselves in. I know you've gotten a lot of pushback on that from Christians. How do you explain how you read the New Testament eschatology, and maybe how other people would maybe feel like you're reading it differently or wrong, or where would that be surprising for a lot of Christians?
I'm not sure which particular pushback you're referring to, because I've had plenty from different angles, of course. But, I mean, I came into this years and years and years ago through reading people like C.S. Lewis, who is very good on the resurrection in his book Miracles, where and also in his early work The Great Divorce, where he is absolutely clear that the final state intended by God the Creator is like this world, only more so. In other words, it is, if you like, more physical, not less, whereas most of us were brought up, really since the Middle Ages, but certainly in my case in the 1950s, on what is basically a Platonic view of the world, that the world of space-time and matter is a rather shabby, bad thing, and that the sooner we get out of it, really the better, and go into a world of pure spirit or soul, which is beyond space-time and matter. And that is Plato and not the Bible. And if you go into the first century looking for people who teach that our souls are exiled from their true home in heaven and that we look forward to them going back there when they're allowed to, then the person you're after is Plutarch, not Paul. And Plutarch is a philosopher, a biographer, a pagan priest at Delphi, and Paul and the others would not have had any truck with that. And the extraordinary thing is that really ever since the Middle Ages, the Western Church, not the Eastern Orthodox Church, though they have other problems, but not this one, the Western Church, Catholic and Protestant, has just swallowed whole this Platonic vision of heaven as the ultimate destination, without seeing that the New Testament itself insists that what matters is new heavens and new earth. In other words, new creation, God renewing the present creation from top to bottom. You can see this in the way that people misinterpret Revelation 21. You can see it in the way that people ignore what Paul says in Romans 8, 18 to 30, when he says that the creation will be set free from its slavery to decay, to enjoy the freedom that it'll have when God's children are glorified. And that is so different from what most Western Christians have been taught, that many people just skip over that and say, well, it's all a bit odd and difficult, I'm not quite sure, whereas in fact it's the climax of the whole letter. So I could go on, but that's the substance of it.
Yeah, and that is, many people, as you've kind of recounted, have heard that and said, well, that's not the gospel that I heard, right? That's not the gospel.
That's right.
I was raised on.
And then you have to say, well, what then do you do with the resurrection? And so people will preach sermons on Easter Day, which say Jesus is risen from the dead, therefore there is a life after death, and we are going to heaven when we die. And that's not the point of the resurrection at all. When Matthew and Mark and Luke and John tell the story of Jesus' resurrection, they none of them say he's raised from the dead, therefore we're going to heaven. Of course, the epistles are very clear that he's raised from the dead, and therefore there is a new life beyond the grave, but they don't describe it in terms of going to heaven.
Yeah, and so, yeah, that places the resurrection of both Christ's body and our body back into the center of this paradigm, doesn't it?
Well, yes, absolutely. This is why another reason why history matters, and it's a reason why the present world matters. Not that it is the final state, but it is the raw material out of which God will bring about the final state.
And so what does that look like in terms of kind of locating ourselves in this story, where we see ourselves in the world, what we're doing as Christians, and so forth?
Yes, and I've written about that in several of my books, about the current social and political responsibilities that we have, not to take over the running of the world or anything silly like that, but to be responsible prayerfully, wisely, to hold rulers and authorities to account and to remind them of their duty, as you can see people like Paul doing in Acts. Indeed, talking about Paul, one of the things he's really quite good at, and in a dangerous sort of way, is standing up to rulers and authorities and reminding them what their job ought to be.
Yeah, and in talking about this, So I think my understanding of what your kind of vision here is that this, the resurrection of Christ, kind of moves outward through his people, leading up to the ultimate kind of resurrection of humanity and the ultimate kind of transformation of the universe, as you talked about Romans 8. Is that a fair way to characterize it?
Yes, except that when you say moving outwards, in a sense that's true, but you can't look back at church history and see it as it were, a steady crescendo. You know, there are some things which have steadily improved over time, and there are more Christians now in the world than there have ever been, but the Christian church has made huge mistakes and in many places has gone backwards and indeed has become extinct. I mean, the great early cradles of Christianity included Western Turkey and North Africa, and you'll be hard put to find any big Christian congregations in Western Turkey or North Africa today. It's one of the bleakest places for Christianity outside countries like Saudi Arabia. But so the church has not simply gone from glory to glory, far from it. It's often got things very badly wrong. However, there are all sorts of assumptions which are shared widely around the world today, such as universal health care in most civilized countries anyway, and such as universal education, and such as the necessary care for the poor. Nobody was doing that in the ancient world. And the fact that those things have entered popular consciousness far beyond the bounds of the church today is in large measure due to the fact that the Christian imperative has actually spread far and wide, and that is all part of the new creation. But then one has to be quite careful that it isn't a matter, and I stress this, it isn't a matter of the world just getting better and better and better, and one day we'll arrive at the kingdom of God or utopia or something. What we have to do at the moment is to plant signs of the kingdom, signposts to the coming kingdom, that these are real anticipations in the present time of what God will do in the end in his mercy and justice and love, but they are not, as it were, the building blocks which are the only thing that God will ever use in that project. The kingdom of God, the ultimate kingdom, remains God's work. God will do it when he wants and how he wants, but what we do in the present really does anticipate that, really does form an advanced part of that.
Yeah, so, you know, that kind of brings up some questions about science and technology. And so I want to ask about how you see the relationship between those things, because one of the things that we see, you know, in the world, and you kind of mentioned healthcare, we see this medical technology working to heal people. Do you see that as playing a role in this, or is it kind of separate from the central question?
Oh, yes. I mean, in the New Testament, you have doctors, and Luke himself is supposedly a doctor. We're not quite sure what sort of a doctor he was or whether he was doing that much practice if and when he was traveling around with Paul, but he is referred to in one of the letters as a doctor. And the church, like ancient Judaism, has always valued the medical profession as contributing to the well-being in the present of human beings who are made in God's image. And, you know, the whole of the Gospels are full of, obviously, stories of Jesus healing people and so on. And it is generally regarded to be a good thing that by whatever means, people can be healed of diseases in order to live fruitful and healthy and creative lives, which is what we are made for as people who reflect God's image. So yes, I mean, obviously, all technology can be used for bad ends as well as good ends, but certainly the rise of medical technology in the last 200 or 300 years is one of the great success stories of science. Science has done some very wicked things, like inventing gas chambers and atom bombs and so on, but it's also had some spectacular, stunning successes, and in medicine and dentistry and so on, these all count.
Yeah. Yeah, very much so. And so, kind of talking about the scientific aspect of it, I want to jump back a little bit. It strikes me that in your kind of historical work, that your approach might be characterized as something like Christology from below. And I wonder, for someone who's kind of coming as a skeptic into this conversation, how they might think about, you know, you're not asking them necessarily to jump all the way to, you know, believing all the statements of the Nicene Creed or something like that, but to start with this kind of historical process. How would you think about that for someone who, you know, how would you explain essentially the New Testament story for someone who doesn't necessarily find any of it believable?
Yeah, it depends which sort of unbelief that they're starting from, as it were. And I think most people today, if they're classifiable as unbelievers, most people in the Western world are probably holding some variety of the ancient philosophy called Epicureanism. People don't realize that, but that's what it is. And you can see this very clearly in the 18th and 19th century at the birth of the so-called modern world. Yeah, your very own Thomas Jefferson proclaimed, "I am an Epicurean." Yeah. And what he meant by that was that Epicureans believed that if there were gods, they were a long way away, upstairs somewhere. They didn't normally intervene in this world, and there wasn't much to do to bother them with. And so the best thing to do is to get on and live as peacefully and comfortably and quietly as you can, because the gods aren't really involved. And that is, of course, that's pretty close to atheism, and indeed trips over into atheism. And I think often the Epicureans only sort of say, well, if there are gods, they're a long way away, as a way of not saying we're actually giving up on them entirely, because that may be socially or culturally unacceptable. Certainly was in the ancient world. So if people are starting there, I want to say, well, there are several different visions of what the word God could mean. And have you ever contemplated the Jewish one, the ancient Jewish one, which is of one God who made the world and has remained involved with it, but not as a celestial CEO pulling levers and pressing buttons, but as a God who is passionately and compassionately involved with the life of the world, particularly in places where there is injustice and poverty and so on. And the prime example being his rescuing of his people from slavery in Egypt. And when people start to think, oh, maybe the word God can mean different things, am I sure which one it is I'm saying I don't believe in, then the conversation can really get going. Because while in a sense I suppose you could say that some of my work at least looks like a Christology from below, that you start with the first century and say, what's going on? Who is this man Jesus? What do we know about him? From another point of view, I start at the other end and I say, look at the stories that first century Jews tell about their God. And these are stories about a God who has promised to do justice and mercy completely, eventually, and who's promised to come and sort the mess out himself in person. You can see it in the Psalms. You can see it in Isaiah, you can see it in Daniel. And then you say, wait a minute, in the first century, they're waiting for this great God event to happen, and then something very extraordinary happens around this man called Jesus, and very quickly people start to tell the story of God in the form of stories about Jesus. Now, is that Christology from above, or is it Christology from the side, or what? I don't much mind, actually. But I think that the important thing is to make people realize there are different ways of talking about God. And if you take the ancient Israelite or ancient Jewish way of talking about the story of God, you'll see that actually it startlingly coincides in the four Gospels with the actual human story of Jesus of Nazareth. And then that story compels you to say, well, either this is total rubbish from top to bottom, or I better actually take it seriously and see just what this might mean.
So that kind of brings up another thing I've heard you talk about, which is the relationship between the human and the divine in Jesus, and then maybe how that reflects on our understanding of the Eastern Orthodox concept of theosis or divinization. How would you describe the relationship there or your thinking on those questions?
Yes, I mean, there's, in a sense, there's two quite separate questions, because the Eastern Orthodox question of theosis is really about the Holy Spirit, because if you believe that God's Holy Spirit is irreducibly God, then if you believe that the Spirit is operating within and active within and through human beings, then unless you see them as sort of empty vessels just rattling around with the Spirit inside, but the Spirit not really affecting them, you have to say they are becoming instruments of, agents of, receptacles of, or something, of the divine, of God himself. And that is taking three large steps towards what the Orthodox mean when they talk about theosis. But the way to understand this is not to talk about the abstract nouns humanity and divinity. I think that's a mistake that the 3rd and 4th and 5th century somehow got led into, because they were trying for all the best motives to communicate the Christian gospel to their contemporaries in the language that their contemporaries might understand. But of course, in the 1st century, if you're a Jew in the 1st century, you have in your midst, in the temple in Jerusalem, an enormous great cultural symbol which says that heaven and earth are not far apart and that God wants to dwell with his people, to live in their midst and to dwell with them in grace and love and healing. And that's what the temple is all about. That's what the liturgy and the Holy of Holies and the sacrifices are all about. So that when then the first Christians tell the story of Jesus, very much focusing on what he eventually does in and to the temple and what he says about the temple, which happens in all four Gospels, then what you're seeing is this symbol of God dwelling with his people somehow being transferred to the question of Jesus. So when we talk about divinity and humanity, these are abstract categories which have been invented subsequently. Nobody in the first century was using those abstract categories. They talked about Israel's God who had promised to dwell with his people, and they talked about this happening in Jesus. And then, yes, as a second stage, they believed that this was happening in and through Jesus' Spirit, which he breathed on his followers after his resurrection. So that the more we learn to think into the minds of the first century Jews who were thinking all this through, the clearer we will become, both about Christology and about whether you call it theosis or pneumatology or what.
Mm. And so that kind of touches on a kind of humorous question I was asked recently. A lot of times you've described the relationship between heaven and earth as being this relationship between kind of different dimensions, not that heaven is, say, up there or completely foreign yep. to the earth, but that it is yep. this different dimension that is supposed to interpenetrate the world. And so the question that was posed was, has Doctor Who influenced the way you think about or describe some of these categories?
No, not at all. I may have watched a few Doctor Who programs maybe 20 or 30 years ago, but I've never been a particular fan. And that whole genre on television or indeed in the movies has never really affected me that much. No, I'm afraid I came to this the old-fashioned way by reading the Bible. Because in the Bible, you know, because when we think of heaven and earth, as I say, we tend to think in Epicurean categories. One of the things we always have to remind ourselves, especially when reading Paul, by the way, is that Epicureanism is the default mode for most people in the modern Western world, but in Paul's world, the default mode was Stoicism, where divinity and the world were all bundled up together. It's basically forms of pantheism, where God and the world are pretty much the same thing. So you've got that on the one hand, and Epicureanism on the other, much more like what people think today of heaven and earth as totally separate. But neither of those represents the way that Jews thought about God. I mean, there were many different ways Jews thought about God, but classically, and if they're reading their Bibles, as many of them were, then Jews thought about God's sphere and our sphere. I use the word sphere very loosely, in interpenetrating ways. Heaven and earth were meant to overlap and interlock. If anyone has any problem about this, I would say please go to Paul's letter to the Ephesians and read chapter 1 carefully and note particularly verse 10 of chapter 1, where Paul says that God's desire and design from the beginning was to sum up all things in heaven and on earth in the Messiah. And that's the whole point, to bring heaven and earth together, not to pull them apart. And actually, that's what the story of the whole Bible is about. And if we don't read that, then we're not getting what the Bible was trying to tell us.
Yeah, so speaking about Paul, what is, you know, I love Paul, and I sense that love in your work, this incredible admiration for this character. But what is the most misunderstood thing about Paul? Because a lot of people maybe are far more critical of him.
Well, yes, people find him easy to criticize. Paul is, of course, a difficult writer because he writes very densely. Sometimes he's writing from prison. Sometimes he's on a journey. He's in danger, as he says, from robbers and shipwreck and goodness knows what. He hasn't got the time in his letters to do the sort of thing that Plato or somebody would do, which is to spell out at great length, inch by inch, rather tediously, this is what I actually mean. He's dashing this off And he's part of the point of what he's doing is teaching people to think. And many people today don't want to be taught to think. They want to be spoon-fed. Just give us three true doctrines and two different ways of behaving, and then that'll be fine. And Paul says, no, 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 you have to learn to think. I'm giving you the tools, but you've got to do the work. And that's of course, what a great teacher ought to do. But then people don't like it. They misunderstand it. They misread him, for instance, on the role of women in church. They reinterpret what he says in terms of their own culture, so that the 16th century reformers interpreted his language about justification in terms of the medieval questions that they were addressing. Now, much better to address those questions with Paul than not to address those questions with Paul, but much better, again, to say, hang on, what were Paul's questions? And when we look at that, then we realize that in every letter Paul writes, he is passionately concerned for the unity as well as the holiness of the church. And we in the modern Western world have almost entirely forgotten that Paul was passionate about unity. So that if Paul came back today, he wouldn't just say, why aren't you united? He would say, why aren't you bothered about the fact that you're not united? And how do you expect the rulers of the world to take any notice of you if you're not together as a single family? And I think that is perhaps the most important thing where Paul is so often misunderstood today. Excuse me, that's my clock striking nine in the background. Oh. It's slightly early, so you're all right.
Okay, there it is. So that's a great point is that there is this whole set of concerns Paul has that he brings to the text that other people aren't maybe thinking about in our current context. What are the background kind of experiences, or what is happening in his life that really brings him to address things in this way?
Well, Paul believes, of course, ever since his experience on the road to Damascus, that Jesus of Nazareth was and is Israel's Messiah. Now, because Paul knows the Psalms and Genesis and Deuteronomy and Isaiah and Daniel and all the rest of it, he knows that when Israel's God finally does what he's promised and sends a Messiah to rescue Israel and renew the world, then this is going to be for the benefit of the whole world, the whole human race, and the whole cosmos. That what God does for Israel is what he's going to do for the world. So if this is the Messiah, and if he's died and been raised from the dead, this tells us that God has done what he'd promised, and it tells us what in fact it looked like when God did what he'd promised, because people weren't quite sure what was actually going to happen. So Paul is rooted in this sense that a great event has occurred as a result of which the world is a radically different place, so that the powers that have enslaved, the dark powers that have enslaved the world have been overthrown, have been defeated, so that all sorts of new things are possible. And one of the first things, of course, is what we call the Gentile mission, that it isn't just a matter of going and saying to people, oh, you out there, maybe Jesus died for you as well. The point is that the Gentiles have been enslaved to the idols that they've worshipped, but with the cross, that enslavement has, in principle, been overthrown, like Pharaoh being overthrown when God rescued the Israelites from Egypt. And so Paul is able to go to the Gentiles, knowing that he can preach the gospel to them, and the Spirit will work in their hearts, and they will come to faith, and he will see that faith as the sure and certain sign that they too are part of God's family. You can see that going on in Acts. That's what justification by faith is all about. And so for Paul, it's this sense that something has happened as a result of which the world is a different place, and Paul is the one who is commissioned and charged with the responsibility of going and founding these little subversive cells of Jesus followers who are living in a different way. Nobody had ever thought of trying to live in this extraordinary egalitarian and philanthropic way, living as a single family across the barriers of ethnic divisions of male, female, of slave, free, etc., etc. And so, not surprisingly, that was seen as subversive and dangerous in his world. And that's why Paul kept on getting into trouble. But that's what makes him tick. That's what he's doing. And unless we latch on to that vision, then we are just really playing around with him and making him dance to our agendas instead of us learning to dance to his.
So one thing you hear a lot is that Paul was kind of just mistaken about what was going to happen in the world, that he thought that the world was going to end within his lifetime and so forth. Would you agree with that, or how would you describe that?
No, that's a modern myth, and actually you can date that modern myth to one or two flickers in the 18th century and then a sudden flurry of misunderstanding in the late 19th and early 20th century. I've written quite a bit about this. There's a long academic article which I just published on this, but also if somebody were to go onto YouTube and look up my Gifford lectures, which I just gave in Aberdeen, then lectures 2 and 4 of my Gifford lectures go into this in some detail. Of course, Paul believed that Jesus was going to come back. He believed that Jesus was going to come back and that it might happen at any time. But Paul does not believe that this had to happen during his lifetime or within a generation or whatever. There is something which was going to happen within a generation very clearly, and that was the fall of Jerusalem, because the early Christians knew Jesus had predicted that and was very clear in Mark 13 and so on. But there's many, many texts come into play here, and I can't possibly rattle through them all on a phone conversation, but this is a modern myth. Paul does believe that the second coming is going to happen, that it might come at any time, but since it might come at any time, I don't think he would be at all fazed by the news that actually you had to wait a lot longer. As indeed, when you go on to the late first century and the second century, people like Clement, Ignatius, Justin Martyr, Polycarp, and on to Irenaeus and Tertullian and Origen, they all believe in the second coming of Jesus. They all know that more than a generation has passed since the time of Jesus. None of them are bothered at all about the fact that it hasn't happened yet. This is basically a modern myth. The only place it finds any purchase in the New Testament is in one line in 2 Peter 3, where you get some people saying, hey, what's going on? Where is the promise of his coming? But the whole of the rest of the New Testament really isn't bothered by this.
So you brought up the question of how he thinks about women and their place in the church. Briefly, could you just describe what you think he thinks versus what maybe we think he thinks?
Okay, I think that the popular image is that Paul was probably misogynistic, that he had it in for women, that he didn't want them making a noise in church, that he pushed them out and certainly wouldn't have had them in any teaching responsibility. Over against that, you simply have to read Romans 16. Now, of course, the joke is that many, many people, when they read Romans, they get as far as chapter 8 and they're exhausted and they don't read any further. But if you pursue all the way through to the end, then you find at the beginning of Romans 16 that when Paul is writing this hugely important, dramatic letter to Rome, he sends the letter with a lady called Phoebe, who is a deacon in the church in Cenchreae, which is near Corinth, where he's writing the letter. And she is, we assume, an independently wealthy businesswoman who's on a business trip to Rome. So Paul sends her with the letter. And it's highly likely that the person who's sent with the letter is the person who will be the first one to read it out when it gets to the other end, and to interpret it, to answer questions about it, to expound it to people who want to be sure that they've got Paul's meaning. So that it's highly likely that the first person to teach on the letter to the Romans was a woman from Greece. Now, if Paul is doing that, then clearly he isn't thinking, oh dear, we better send a man as well to make sure that the man can do the teaching. But likewise, the whole of the rest of Romans 16, he's sending greetings to people he knows in Rome, many of whom are women in leadership positions in the church, including one called Junia, who is an apostle. Some people have tried to argue that Junia wasn't an apostle, but it's very, very clear from a whole raft of contemporary scholarship that Junia certainly was an apostle. So that along with that, you have to say, well, in 1 Corinthians 11, Paul envisages women praying and prophesying in church, and his concern there is not to shut them up, but that they look like women by wearing appropriate female dress rather than being in some way androgynous. Because Paul is a theologian of creation and new creation, and for him, men are men and women are women, and should celebrate that fact, not not try to pretend otherwise. There are other passages. There's a couple of verses towards the end of 1 Corinthians 14. There's the famous passage in 1 Timothy 2. I have written about those in my commentaries, The New Testament for Everyone, and also in an article on this subject in my book, Surprised by Scripture. And that's probably the best place to go if people wanted to follow that up.
Yeah, so I know we're out of time. I've got so many questions, and there's so much to unpack here. But I'll let you go. Thanks so much for talking through this with me. And I'm gonna put a link up to your new book. Anything else that people should check out?
Yeah, there's the new book, of course, as you say, but there's also a series of online courses, including one on the new book, actually. Mm-hmm. And those online courses are at www.ntwriteonline.org. And there's, I don't know, 15 or 16 online courses, which I've done through the Wisconsin Center for Christian Studies, actually. They've masterminded it. And those are available. People can sign up for them. And we've already got, several thousand students. We've only been going 2 or 3 years on that, from over 150 countries. It's quite extraordinary what the web does these days. So www.ntwriteonline.org, and there's all sorts of fun stuff happening there.
Okay, very much. I'll put a link to that. I'll put a link to the book on Paul and also Surprised by Hope, which came up. Thanks so much again, and hope to talk to you sometime down the road in the future.
Thank you very much. Been good talking to you.
All right.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye-bye.